Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you've had a chance to reflect on what we discussed last time, and I want to be sure that if you have any questions or clarifications, that we can discuss them now while we still have an open mic. Thank you for all of the responses that you've sent for the question about what you'd most like to focus on and take away. Questions, thoughts, ideas that you'd like to discuss briefly before we move into our material. We're going to be talking about the craft of writing, and I want to share there are a couple of passages that I want to share with you that really illustrate voice, because that's something that's kind of elusive, but I think there are two or three of my favorite authors that really illustrate, in my view, voice, and I'm going to include that in our discussion today. But we're going to really discuss more about the system of writing, the craft of writing. How do you, you know, what do you do after you sit down and stare at a blank page? So any thoughts or questions from last time about the art of writing or any things you want to be sure that we cover today? You've probably looked at the outline maybe about what we're going to discuss. So anything you want to highlight or note or just add? Anyone? Okay, I'm going to move in order not to remain lonely, I'm going to move into the material unless there's somebody who wants to say something or have a conversation. Did I hear someone?
Dave, this is Michael. I was just going to
say... Hey, how are you?
I was getting
lonely there for a minute. Thank you. How are you doing?
I know. I was thinking I need to say something. Poor Dave is going to get all upset. Isn't he? Well, last time you had mentioned the importance of the book proposal. So, you know, that's a section coming up that
yes.
I think I really want to sort of focus on. And I think number three, markets, and, you know, you'll get to that, I'm assuming, but I was a little unclear
yes.
about, you know, what you meant by markets. So I just wanted to...
Well, we're going to talk about that more in the business of writing. The whole aspect of what do you do after you do, but how do you sell it, or to look at that in preparation for it to help orient and guide you to look at how you go about it and what you do, because all of that kind of fits into an overall plan. So, yeah, we're definitely going to cover that. Yeah, super.
Okay.
Was there someone else who I heard? If not, we'll launch into our discussion. I'll put us on lecture mode, and we'll come back at the end and have a time for discussion. If there are any questions or clarifications or things that the discussion prompts that you'd like to talk about. Okay, as we talk about the craft of writing, one way to think about it is you learn to do something by doing it. Writing is no different. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You become an author by rewriting. And Mark Twain put it simply, writing's easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words. So here are some reflections as we talk about the craft of writing, since you're the author of your life story and your written story. What do you do uniquely well, better than anybody else? Who's your audience? In setting your writing goals, be clear about three things. What your readers need from you, what you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you want to convey to the reader. Now, here are some things to reflect on to understand your motivation for publishing. And understand, I'm saying publishing now, not exactly writing. There are 12 and counting. P people want to write for myriad reasons and want to publish for a number of reasons. Here are some reasons that people want to write to publish. One, to disseminate your knowledge, your experience, and your message to readers. As a gift to clients. As a premium with some other offer, like an ebook for a bonus for subscribing to your platform, your newsletter, or whatever you're offering. To publish with a traditional house using an agent to establish a national presence as an author. To make money by selling your book for yourself. And hear how none of these are mutually exclusive or there's only one answer here. To use your book to make money for other services and products. To establish yourself as an expert. To enhance your client base. As a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, retreats. To develop mastermind groups or discussion groups based on your book. To make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we each really would like to change the world. You know I'm right. Here's Tom Stoppard, a British playwright, put it very simply. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. And finally, to leave a legacy. And this is a kind of a personal sidebar, but here's how the dedication of one such book, A Memoir on Parenting, sounds. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you will find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not really revealing anything new. I can't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through all your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. That's from Making Memories, my reflections on parenting from the heart of a father and the mind of a psychoanalyst. I'll return to that later as an example of one publishing option. Let's talk about voice for just a moment. Definite voice is conversational voice. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic storyteller, a skilled raconteur, rather than simply looking at words on paper. Now, this is different from the simple advice, write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription, or I'd never need to do anything other than turn my dictation device on, which is the way I write. I just, you know, get it transcribed and send it in, wherever in is. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision. Transcribing talk is not writing, but it is one technique to help cultivate voice. As some writers speak into recording devices, let their voices flow and hear themselves at the same time. One step in your editing process is to read your words out loud. Then you can recast a word or a sentence that doesn't sound quite right. Barbara McClintock awarded a Nobel Prize for her study of gene transposition in corn plants. Said she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She described respecting the life and presence of the corn and, as she put it, letting it come. She said she learned the stories of the plants. She heard them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in a way a healer or a mystic would have known them from the inside by hearing the inner voices of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, even in previously contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. I suspect if I mused out loud to a colleague that some vegetables were talking to me, they'd call the guys in the white coats. For Barbara, though, it was a true exchange. From the perspective of voice, listen to this short passage. I think you'll hear immediately the voice. I use this passage. Also, it happens to fit with my philosophy of coaching, though I didn't know it at the time, as a preface of my last book written as a psychoanalyst, Integrating Body Self and Psychological Self. It's from Anatoly Briard's Intoxicated by My Illness. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant trying to see how he would make the premises more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure out what it's like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. We would wrestle with my fate together like Rupert and Birkin in the library and D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give him some of my art in exchange for his. He was cared for well by his doctor. He died shortly after that with his illness. His voice in one paragraph, I think you can know more about the mind and soul of this man than you do many of your friends and acquaintances after several years. Let me read a couple of other passages that I think indicate voice, just to give you a feel. And these are all some of my favorite authors, but people who have a definite voice. And I'll bet after really listening to it in this way, you could pick up anything that they've written and know immediately within a sentence or two that they wrote, even if you knew nothing else about it and it was anonymous. Here's from Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. He was, as you know, a neurologist. My work, my life is all with the sick. But the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might not otherwise have had, so much that I am compelled to ask with Nietzsche, as for sickness, are we not almost tempted to ask whether we could get along without it, and to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature? Constantly my patients drive me to question, and constantly my questions drive to patience. Thus, the stories or studies which follow here, there is a continual movement from one to the other. One other passage I want to read. This is from Annie Dillard, The Writing Life. When you write, lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gouge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You will know tomorrow, or this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearfully. You go where the path leads, and the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. So those are just illustrations of voice, and you can see how it really captures the essence, the soul of someone when they convey what they think and feel and experience in words in this way, and you get to know them at another level. So, to the craft of writing, let's look at a system for this. First, design every part of your book. The title, 5 words or less that tells and sells. The subtitle, the promise, the benefits described, what the reader's going to get as a benefit from reading it. And I'll tell you a little bit more about why I'm so specific about 5 words. We'll revisit these in a moment in the book outline. The subtitle is the promise and the benefits. The silver bullet now is a clear, sharply focused description of your book that can be recited in just a sentence or two. It should clearly explain what your book is about, why it's special, and the precise benefits it will provide to readers. Although if you've done a good job, the title and the subtitle have already done this. The mission statement, a 7 to 9 word statement of the purpose of your book. Think of it like a hub statement. The back cover. Think about, before you write your book, write the back cover, a compelling ad copy of benefits to the reader. The book introduction. This is where you begin to sample. Where, think about when you pick up a book. Let's say you go to a brick-and-mortar store or go to Amazon and click on the look inside. You begin the first paragraph or two of the introduction. This is the sample. This is the beginning of a relationship. And you're deciding as you enter this relationship if you're going to continue it or not. So the book introduction is the problem you address for your specific audience, why you wrote it, its purpose, its benefits, and how you're going to present it. The table of contents and the book outline. Now, let's look more specifically at the nonfiction book proposal about why this is important, even if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house. The book proposal is the outline of the book. It's the blueprint for the architect, the business plan of your book. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So you should have the end in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take? She asked. Where do you want to go? Asked the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. So the book proposal, your book outline, is your blueprint about how you're going to proceed. This may take, for a nonfiction book, a quarter or a third of the time that it takes to write the book, because this is the whole structure, the whole ideas, in detailed outline form. You develop an organizing idea about what's your book about? Why does it exist? Because you're going to communicate this again and again in various ways through the book. The title, subtitle, the headline sentences, the chapter subtitles, they all fit a brand, the essence of your book. The nonfiction book proposal, and we're going to go into the detail here, is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of the book. Another purpose of the proposal, the original purpose, was to tell a publisher about your book, why it's important, why you're the one to write it, why it will be successful. And it shows how well you organize and write about what you're going to write about. So a good book starts with good ideas. So it addresses these questions. Why would someone want to read your book? Who's your target audience? Why is your book unique? Is there a unique hook and a message to support an entire book? What will I be telling my readers that they don't already know? So let's look at these components of a book outline. One, the title and subtitle. The title should contain no more than 5 words. Why is that? Well, a longer title requires the reader to think about it instead of to feel and to react. You have to hold some words in mind and then think about the relationship, fit them all together. The title should create a motivating visualization. We know that more people think in pictures and learn in a visual way than in an auditory and kinesthetic way put together. So the title should trigger positive images, not negative ones, or to reverse a negative idea or problem. Now, there are exceptions, but its focus should also be positive, not avoiding a negative, because neuroscience tells us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. And the title should pass the airplane test. And this is my personally devised test that came to me spontaneously when a publisher asked me to write a blurb for the dust jacket of a book that they were publishing. An author who I knew, a publisher who was well respected, and I asked what the book's title was. And the publisher told me, he said, you know, I'd be happy to review the book if it had a different title, but that one doesn't pass the airplane test. He said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? I said, if I'm on an airplane and somebody sees me reading a book, I don't want to be embarrassed by its title or feel stupid to be reading it or have somebody wonder if I have whatever problem the title promises the book will fix. He thanked me, had the author change the title, sent me a nice bound galley to review, and it went on to be a bestseller. And there are exceptions to everything. Here's one exception to the rule of five words or less for a title. It happens to be a bestseller by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolfe. This is the title. Get out of my life, but first could you drop me and Cheryl off at the mall? Second, the overview. A compelling overview of your book, 1 to 2 pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of a book rather than, for example, a magazine article or a newspaper story or a series of blogs. The overview should be a clear, concise statement of four elements: what the book's about, why it should be written, how you're going to write it, and why you're the best person to write it. A third thing to think about as you're doing a book proposal, even if no one else sees it, markets. This section should contain information about who's going to buy your book, who you're writing the book for, why your book should exist, your strategy to sell it. You're beginning to think about the challenges of the target audience of your book. Four, the competition. This is a section in a book proposal that spells out the results of your research and assessment as to the viability of what you're doing, the competition, complementary books, competitive books, and how you support the idea of your book's existence. Five, promotion. What you're going to do to help promote or sell your book, including with all formats. This is the main thing that if you think about submitting to an agent, this is going to be the first question that your agent asks you, even before you have a chance to say what the working title of the book is. The question, what's your platform? In other words, how many people do you have following you, who know you, who are going to be ready to buy your book? Because that's the first question that a publisher will ask that agent whenever it's submitted. That is the first question you should ask regardless of any one of the 8, 9, or 10 directions or types of publishing that we're going to discuss, because this is what it's about to sell books. How many people know you or are willing to buy? So this is what you want to develop, your following. I'll give you a couple of examples of how that can be leveraged in just a minute. Six, the author's background. Emphasize your background and your experience as it relates to your book. And seven, this is really important. This is the bones of your book, the chapter outline. this section, its organization, is crucial. It should contain a table of contents and a chapter-by-chapter outline of each of the chapters of your book. The outline is a synopsis of each chapter. It may be as little as 2 or 3 paragraphs or up to a page each. So if you have 12 chapters, you probably should have something around 12 pages as a chapter outline, because this is where the writing of the book happens. You already have the overview, what you're going to add to and have contained in each chapter. This is how you write, is the preparation, the planning, looking at what you're going to do. This is your blueprint for the book. The chapter abstracts allow you to show what you can do without having to write the book as well. So if you submit to a traditional publisher a nonfiction book, you don't have to have the whole book written. You may want, in addition to a book outline, a sample chapter, probably the first chapter, but that's all you need, because they're going to make a decision on the basis of that. So number 8, sample chapter. Usually chapter 1, but it sort of proves you can do the job, but it also proves it to yourself. Engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at any bestseller, any nonfiction bestseller that you go to. You can do this on Amazon. Look at the first chapter. It will begin with a story. A powerful story engages the reader, captures the essence of the book's message. So this nonfiction book proposal probably is somewhere around 20 to 40 pages, plus the sample chapter. Now, it's your preparation. This is for you. It's your game plan, your superstructure. It serves as a map for you, because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book, to articulate what the book is about. It requires you to think about why you're the person to write it, why anyone would be interested in it. These are the demands you need to be placing already on yourself when you consider writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating your book may be about investigating your idea and writing your book proposal. Here are still the 2 best books, and they're updated, new editions and all, but these are the 2 best books for writing a book proposal. One is by Michael Larsen, L-A-R-S-E-N, How to Write a Book Proposal. The other is by Jeff and Deborah Herman, Write the Perfect Book Proposal. Almost any writer you talk to will have one or the other as a favorite how-to book. Mine is the Herman book. My wife's is Larsen. Anybody is going to pick one or the other. They're very different. The reason I like the Herman book is they have several examples of various kinds of book proposals that worked, so you can get an idea of what those things look like when they've been successful. So there are 7 habits, and counting, of course, of successful writers. 1, and remember, I'm saying this as if it's absolute. Remember, nothing is more clear than for the purposes of discussion. So these are ideas to see what you think about them. 1, create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. Remember, we said if you want to create a change a habit, create a new habit, or write a book, focus on the system. Stick with your schedule no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, as well as in writing, is to show up. You know, we've touched before. Stephen King said, you know, you don't wait for the muse to show up. You sit at your desk every day between 8 and 3, and you wait for the muse to find you. This schedule is simply a writing plan that doesn't have to be detailed or onerous. It may look like some version of one of these possibilities. I'll write for 2 hours, 5 days a week between 8 and 10 p.m. I'll draft 500 words of writing each day for 5 days a week. I will create two chunks a week. We're going to come back to chunks. I will create an outline of the book by fill in the date. I will create an annotated outline by fill in the date. Or if it's one of your favorite writers, I will be immersed in writing for a 5-week retreat in October of every year in a 300-year-old Creole home in the French Quarter and do nothing but write. Focusing on a simple, specific action plan sets up the best potential for your effectiveness and mastery. Divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Here's an illustration. A few of you may have heard me tell this story. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything seemed just really curiously out of focus. And I knew this guy was a photographer, so I never figured. As I met with him each week, I glanced at the photograph until finally, toward the end of the year, I mustered up courage and asked him about it. He said, "Look carefully, Dave. What do you see?" Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value in it. My experience and interest in photography, I'd been published in National Geographic, but I couldn't figure out this. I said, "Steve, the only thing I notice is there's only one branch in one tree that's in focus in the entire picture." And he nodded and smiled. He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing you can have in focus and see clearly," which is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents when everything was out of focus. Two, when you write, write. Don't combine writing and editing. Two different mindsets, two different parts of the brain. You can't do both at the same time. It takes too much energy to change states back and forth. Different parts of the brain are involved. Plan separate times for each task. Maybe even coordinate it with your biorhythms of what time of the day you're most creative to write. Three, take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal. Write in maybe small bursts. The first draft can be done at various times, bit by bit. Maybe a compilation of several stacks of pages from a lot of different times. Here's an example of one step at a time. And I know some of you have heard me tell this story. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average, though, 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was asked, how did he keep going when he was exhausted, knew he had thousands of miles ahead? He said, "I just kept running to the next telephone pole." Four, find your most efficient way of writing and stick to it. Whether it's the computer, if you especially are visual and like to see the words manifest, writing longhand on a yellow pad if you're kinesthetic and like the feel of it, or if you're more auditory, dictating and you're speaking to your audience. Do what fits your learning and creativity style. Also pay attention to the best time of the day for the creative process of writing, the best time of the day for the more objective work of editing. Pay attention to your biorhythms. In Texas, it sounds like this. It's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. Five, read your work aloud. This can be a really effective way of editing. Usually a final edit can be reading it out loud. It's a way of listening on another level. If possible, join a writer's group. I've done this at various times, and it's always interesting to hear someone else read your writing, because you don't get to say, no, wait, you should have paused. Now emphasize it. You get to hear it like a reader is going to read it. So it's way more objective. 6, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information of themselves, as well as regarding to books, websites, reports, and interviews. One way that I get information and do research daily is I have a couple of dozen Google alerts, and those Google alerts send an email for each alert once a day, and the title, a little abstract, and the link of any of the articles, the papers, the books, anything that appear, blogs, which is how your blog goes viral, appears on in that little abstract in those 3 or 4 lines. So if there's something of interest, I'll click on it and look it up and see if it's something that is of interest. I'll copy it, put it in a stack, and go through the stacks every week or two. In other words, I don't stop and go through a paper there. It's just not efficient. You want to stay in the same state. So that's one way of doing it, and to have Google Alerts for anything that relates to what you are interested in writing about, researching, anything that is going to be complementary to your research, your interviews, your writing. And 7, read the writing of others. We learn by reading. Read what instructs as well as stimulates. I would say read from other related fields. Stretch yourself. You'll find your own best balance for reading and writing. When I write about the mind and brain science applied to whatever fill in the blank is, the last 3 years have been peak performance, you wouldn't believe the number of different kinds of books that I go through in a stint or on a weekly basis. I mean, you know, everything from SEAL training to various kinds of sports application. I mean, just there's a whole broad number of things that can be from basic research to various kind of applications that can be stimulating. Here are the top 6 mistakes successful writers avoid, since you ask. 1, avoid passive sentence construction. As you reread and edit your work, convert passive verbs into active language whenever possible. 2, strive to be clear, specific, simple, and humane. These are the 4 qualities of good writing, William Zinsser, The Art of Writing. These also happen to be, for those of you who have trained with me, you know how much I'm a stickler on 10 words or less, clear, brief, simple, and humane. 4, asking questions of coaching, conversing with someone. This makes for cognitive ease when you are clear, brief, simple, specific. Somebody doesn't have to continue paying attention for more than 10 words to know what you're saying, and they can be all in terms of responding. I tell my coaches, when you ask a question, be sure what you really want to ask and what you really want your client to think about is in those first 10 to 12 words. Because if you go on and elaborate and extend it, they're going to be beginning to plan what they have for dinner that night, wait until you're through, and come back to those first 10 words. So be sure those are the most important ones. 3. Show, don't tell your audience. And I wanted to say the reason that these 4 principles of writing, Zinsser calls them the 4 rules of good writing, because that means we do the work of editing. We keep the burden of clarity ourselves, the burden of the clarity of communication. We don't shift it to the reader or listener to try to discern, to try to figure out what we're really saying. We keep it simple and make it look easy. And that's hard work, as you know, at times. 3, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories, metaphors, combining a good story with the right brain with pointing out the story's lesson. The left brain engages both sides of the brain for balanced learning. People accept ideas more readily when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. Show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action and dialogue drama about one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the scientist who with Crick discovered DNA, said, "You know, I can remember something when it fits into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. It makes things make sense. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. I used to consult with lawyers to help them craft a story for the jury so that they didn't ask the jury to make a decision at the beginning, you know, to find somebody guilty or find somebody innocent, but to craft a story where they were together, went step by step, and an ideal story, the juror would come to the conclusion one step before the attorney did, and it felt like it was theirs. Muriel Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." 4, keep the I to a minimum in order to acknowledge and engage your reader. It's going to be about them. 5, lose the jargon and the fancy phrases. Hemingway believed that 1 to 2 syllable words work better than longer ones. So don't try to impress your audience with your intellect or vocabulary or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, who also happens to be an expert. And 6, work at the craft of storytelling. When you carefully craft a speech or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the desired emotional response from listener or reader. We're going to talk about the neuroscience of constructing a story. So rather than expressing yourself or telling what the receiver, the reader's action should be, you enable the reader to have the emotional experience. We can learn from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to their own experience, for the audience to have the feeling. One of the storytellers I studied with, I did this right after I made my transition to professional coaching from psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. I knew my stories had to get way better. I studied with someone who crafted stories. He told of an experience he had going through an airport in Chicago. A woman stopped him to say how much she enjoyed his presentation, how it had stayed with her all these years. He asked her to remind him what he had talked about. And she said, "Oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told." So here's an exercise, a chunking exercise. A chunk is a piece of writing, maybe about the size of a newspaper column, on a single subject. So exercise 1, write a single chunk. Treat the single subject in a complete self-contained way. This may be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, a case study. It should be on the subject related to your book. Get it down in writing. 2nd exercise, write 4 more chunks. And you'll see that chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. What works for me is anytime I have an idea, anytime I read something, think of something, when I'm driving back and forth to my ranch on the weekend, I have a little dictation device anywhere I may sit, I'll pick it up and dictate something. Now, I usually have a little left-hand margin title or what it's about, so I can stack all of, when I print it, when I get it back from the transcriptionist at a penny and a quarter a word, which is really easy, I can stack them or put them in a folder along the lines of a particular topic that could also be called chapters. And you'll see that chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. Third exercise, fit your chunks into the outline. See what the chunks illustrate or describe to further a section or a specific chapter of your book. And the fourth exercise, this is in your outline, plan a month of writing. After you've written five chunks, fitted them into your outline, you may want to revise your outline. After revision, decide what chunks you're going to write next. Cue your radar for what you're about to do. For these, you'll be more aware of what you want to write and can make a writing schedule. So here are some important areas of focus for a serious writer. One, the mission statement of your book. Now, in business, a mission statement is a statement of an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, the fundamental values. A personal mission statement can clarify and give meaning to your daily activities. It can add focus and commitment to what you do. So consider the mission statement for your book. There are four parts of the mission statement: ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. Ideals are the core values that motivate and guide you and define the important elements of what you're going to convey. The purpose, what do you want to accomplish? The benefits the reader gets. Strategy, the art and science of a plan of action, your system. This has to do with how you're going to conceive, craft, and deliver your book, a specific system. And goals, the most simple goals that we all know are SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, time-bound. So create a mission for yourself as a writer. It can guide you and remind you of what you're meant to do. It can become a compass to guide your story to completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. Two, a business plan for your book. This is the book proposal. Three, a timetable. Think about a calendar of completion of each aspect of your book. SMART goals has a T on the end, remember, time-bound. A daily schedule, a structure. Your writing office, the space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized, it should be something that supports your writing, your identity as a writer, your containment of focus, no interferences, your tools, adequate support, computer, business stationery, books, reference, whatever is related to your writing. Seven, continuing education in writing. In your subject matter, include marketing, even if you're going to publish with a blue chip publisher. Get conversant with marketing because you're going to have to. Eight, a writer's group. The huge leaps forward that I made have come from attending two writer's groups at the University of Iowa. This is kind of at the beginning of writing in a different way than just scientific papers and professional books. In them, I learned as much from the other participants as I did from the writer who coordinated the groups. At a University of Houston imprint series, we did something I've subsequently incorporated into a boot camp for writers that I've conducted. Hearing your own writing, as I mentioned, read by somebody else. You can't tell the reader where to pause or whether or not to use a certain inflection. You'll find objectively listening to your own work read aloud really beneficial. And finally, your belief systems. If you want to change your life, first change your mind. So how do you do an inventory of beliefs that may be limiting or compromising? Because the definition The blind spot is you can't see it. Well, analogous to impressionistic painting, each of your experiences is a dab of paint on a pontilus canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize that the points form a pattern of a particular segment of life, that the segments have their own unity and organization. You create each experience, the patterns, the composite image. To say this a different way, whatever you think and feel and experience, you create each moment. If you don't like it, if it's not working, think about creating something different. You're always free to change your mind, always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. This is something I carried forward from practicing therapy and analysis. There were maybe two or three different times I had a patient do this, and I've done it once or twice with a client. I would ask that person to say out loud three times, "I am always free to change my mind." When they did, by the time they did it the third time, and heard themselves saying it, it had an impact. They really came to see the possibility there. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, but can transform your life. But first you have to be aware. Prediction, expectation, based on the past, create repetition. But when based on possibility, can create a different present and future. A belief system constructs an obstacle or an opportunity. Either way, it's constructed by you. Consider this. What you seek can be camouflaged in what you fear. To say this a different way, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. Because we always create the outside to match the inside. Now, the secret here is that an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but makes it safe to want if you're afraid. You've heard me, some of you have heard me say this. So I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking relentlessly at a cat, as if to say, "Just let me at him." And the cat wasn't too shabby, looked kind of mean, at least as big as the dog. All of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, in the third frame, the leash snapped, so the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked scared to death, astonished. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot, then could again strain safely at the leash and bark his ferocious, "Just let me at him." So, here's the coaching application. And for yourself in writing, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, "I can't find time to write," reflect on the underlying desire. Here's the principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like to create possibility instead of obstacle. Requires the same amount of energy. We're in discussion mode now, so I'm interested in any thoughts or questions that any of you have, or any reflections you'd like to share with our group.
Yeah, this is Carol.
Okay, please, Nate.
Yeah, I just have one thing to add to the 6 mistakes successful writers avoid. Don't be afraid to throw out your little darlings.
Okay, yeah. That's so hard because our identity is tied up with what we write, and it's like we always return to our identity and want to keep it. So, yeah, absolutely. That's a great one. Yeah. Thank you.
Dave, can you – excuse me. Michael,
yeah,
again.
Go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit about what the difference is between a mission statement, a hub statement, and a silver bullet?
Okay, the hub statement comes from coaching, where it's as you know, it's the statement of the specific who, the niche, that you want to direct your marketing effort, and the benefits that you'll bring. So the mission statement is the overall purpose of a book, why you're writing your book, what you want to do to convey the entire purpose of your book. I'll share my life mission statement, if that would help, to inspire and guide people to achieve their unique, most empowered life and business story. Now, I would say, compare that to a plot. Here's my plot, for example. To live, love, contribute, and play with absolute passion. Now, your purpose, your mission would need to be yours, but I'm just crystallizing some concepts here to think about your book, to think about what you want to do and how you want to do it, what your purpose is.
So would it be fair?
Again?
I'm sorry. Would it be fair to say the mission statement is private? It's not for anybody else. It's for me. The hub statement is more like an elevator speech. It's what I can use to explain to other people what the book is about.
Yeah. And I would say for like the hub statement, lose the whole idea about elevator speech, because nobody ever bought anything on an elevator. And if you think that, well, you got 20 or 30 seconds, people are going to start punching the button to get off before they thought it. So if you can say it in 10 words or less, you're in business. This comes, I think some of you have heard me say that one of my buddies and collaborators, Mark Waldman at Loyola Marymount MBA program, has done some research on conversational intelligence, and specifically about using 10 words or less, because what neuroscience shows us is that we attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time. After that, our attention begins to tail off and we don't retain nearly as well. What he did was to do research in groups that were contentious, to make this even challenging, divorce, mediation, arbitration. And he had each side agree to use only 10 words, and he had them put two fists up. And each time they used one word, they would put up one digit, and when they ran out of digits, they had to stop, and they agreed to do this. When they did this, they reached resolution in 20 to 30% of the time that it usually took, and the resolution was significantly more satisfying than usual. So one of the reasons this 10-10 principle and clarity, brevity, simplicity is helpful is that it works. It's the way our brains work. Because if there's cognitive ease, we're going to attend to it and remember it. If it's a strain, if it's a little bit too much, we have to remember what somebody said at the beginning and what they said then. You know, it's a little bit of work. We don't, the speaker doesn't keep the burden of clarity himself or herself. And that's exactly the purpose of this. The whole idea, and we're going to talk some more about this, Yuri Hassan said this in a very simple way. Imagine you invented a device that can record your memories, your dreams, your ideas, and transmit them to your brain. That would be a game-changing technology, right? Well, we already possess this device. It's called storytelling. And that was his comment about your brain on communication. Because, and we know stories are way more important than facts in changing our minds, because storytelling allows us to identify with ideas and people and have a way of remembering, having a way of connecting, you know, in as recently as 1996 in Parma, Italy. This was discovered accidentally, that when one monkey looked at another monkey having an experience, the same part of the observing monkey's brain fired as the monkey having the experience. This is how we came to discover and then develop the whole notion of mirror neurons and using that to inform empathy. This is exactly what happens when we measure what happens when somebody reads, when they read something that activates a sensory modality, a smell, an action. You know, the part of the brain that records this is activated. So this is why it's so important to know this and to use this in ways of communicating and to make that communication more vivid and more memorable. Yeah, so thanks for does that help address that that question?
Yeah, okay. I think so. And is the silver bullet essentially the hub statement? Are they the same thing, or is there?
It's really a conveying of what your book is about and why it's going to be beneficial in a very succinct way. What's going to be the silver bullet that cuts through everything else and really presents in a very succinct way why this is so powerful? What's it going to do? What does it do?
So there's a focus on the benefits and
yes.
How readers are going to benefit. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Other thoughts? We've got. I'm sorry. We're over. I didn't recognize that. Thank you all very, very much, and I appreciate your emails and responses and kind words. I look forward to picking up right here next time. Have a great week. And if there are any questions or clarifications as you think about it, and those of you who are maybe listening to the recording and couldn't come, let me know, and we'll have a brief discussion beginning of the next seminar. So thanks very much. Have a good week. Take good care of yourselves. See you guys. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Take care, Dave.